Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks.
I am Krampus, fear my name. Far and wide extends my fame. I arrive when I am bidden, and sniff out children where they're hidden. Who is naughty? Where's my prey? I'll tear them up without delay. And daily though I do my spying, I've scarcely seen a child trying. Good children, though, are not my task. Only for the bad I'm asked. For those my sack is neatly suited, their vexing screams and whining muted. Off I pack them to their fates, the spoiled little retrobates. With brats as these, one choice is fit to toss them in the fiery pit.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Greetings, Monster Talkers. It is I, Blake Smith, your host here at Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. You just heard the mellifluous intonations of Wilkinson, appearing courtesy of the Bone and Sickle podcast, where he serves dual roles. First, he's Al Ridenour's Gentleman's Gentleman. And second, and perhaps of more interest to listeners, he's Al's Consonance Companion. He appears tonight thanks to a special arrangement with Bone and Sickle, and if you like the rich and haunting quality of his voice, be sure to check out our show notes at monstertalk.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to the Bone and Sickle podcast, and wherein you'll find each episode has been audibly bedazzled with dozens of Wilkinson's sonorous syllables, perhaps even more than we deserve. Here in Georgia, the sun is crushing us beneath its blistering heels, and I thought it would be fun to take our minds to cooler climes and spend some time talking about the lore around the Krampus. This goat-horned, demon-faced creature normally makes his appearances during the Christmas season, but I thought it might be nice to take some time to cool off to these alpine legends and to drift to sleep to the far-off intonations of a different kind of Christmas bell. Join us now as we settle down by the Yule log, while outside, flakes of snow kiss lightly on the frosted glass of our study window. It's time for Krampus in July.
Monster Talk.
Al Ridenour is the author of the gorgeous, grotesque, and fascinating book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas. He's also the host of the podcast Bone and Sickle, and honestly, I cannot overemphasize how much I think listeners of Monster Talk will enjoy both of these things. Get the book, subscribe to the podcast, you should do it. In fact, why don't you pause this show, go and find Bone and Sickle, and then add it back to your feed, and then come back here. You won't be sorry. I'll wait. Hopefully you came back. All right. Al does an amazing job of collecting fascinating folklore, contextualizing it with references to the source material, and much more information about the era from whence it comes. And he does it all with a delightful style that I find enviable, despite the paucity of puns in his content. So welcome to Monster Talk, Al Ridenour.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be on the show. I'm a longtime listener.
Me too. And I really do love your show. Is this your first podcast that you're doing, your Bone and Sickle? Is this the first one you've put together yourself?
Yes, it is. I started it thinking that I would just mine my Krampus book and that would be nothing to it. I'll just read it out of my book. It'll be simple. And while I'm learning, I sort of can't stop myself when it comes to making things complex and dense and so forth. So I haven't even really used much from my Krampus book yet, but come the season I may. But yeah, this is the first time I've done a podcast. I've done other audio and video stuff, but never put them together like this before.
It is. It's wonderful. And I love the sound design. I love the sort of characters that you've put together and the whole concept. And for listeners, this is how I would describe it. I guess there's sort of this artificial layer where it appears to be you and your valet or valet, depending on where you're from, sitting in a library discussing folklore. And it has a sort of steampunk Victorian feel to it. But the stuff you talk about is all real folklore.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's so much deeper and more sincere than a lot of the content you would find in a especially from a first time podcaster. I mean, it's really well done. So I love it. And I can't obviously give you big piles of money, but I give you a hearty endorsement.
Thank you. I should point out it's not just folklore. It's horror and folklore.
This is true. Yeah, yeah.
It's just the folklore to find the darkest, creepiest stories. And there's a little history thrown in. But folklore, horror. That would be the way to describe it.
You know, I always feel funny about asking this question because it seems like every time we interview somebody, it's always, how did you get interested in this? But when I really thought about it today, I was thinking about, like, for people who don't know much about whatever the topic is, it really is an important question. Why did you get passionately interested in this topic? And then today we're talking about Krampus. And we're talking about Krampuses, or whatever it's not a single monster. As you put in the book, it's not Dracula, it's vampires, right?
Right.
Right.
And for that reason, I do say, you'll have to all forgive me. I will say the Krampus instead of Krampus because it's not a proper noun. So I will say the versus just Krampus. And it's also how it's said in German. So how I got interested in the Krampus or the Krampuses, and I also constantly hear people ask me about the plural because they want to say Krampi because it sounds like it's a Latin word, so they want to do that Latin pluralization. But I just say Krampuses because we're Americans here. Krampusa is how you'd say it in German, but I think you can go with Krampuses. In any case, how I got interested? I was in my undergrad years. I studied German literature, language and literature, and that sort of was added to a childhood obsession with monsters. And when I started to sort of get this inkling of these creepy folk traditions, I sort of filed it away because at the time when I was in school, there really wasn't that much information about the Krampus in English-speaking countries. So, in fact, even after I graduated, I went to live in Berlin for a year. I wasn't sure where I was going after undergrad, and I was studying at the university in Berlin. But I still didn't know that much about it to the point that around Christmas, I remember walking in some store and seeing these racks of these beautiful old lithographs of devil heads, and not really recognizing it as the Krampus. This is in the 80s, sometime late 80s. But I remember buying one and putting it on my fridge. And then, lo and behold, years later, my house is filled with these things.
That's awesome.
And I don't just mean postcards and masks and everything. I grew up watching old monster films, horror films, and add to that the German interest in German culture. And then around the early 2000s, I think a lot of us started, thanks to the internet, started seeing – first, I think it was the people started scanning the old photos. Or there's a collector in Chicago named Monty Beauchamp who published a few lovely collections of the old Krampus postcards. So those started popping up on the internet. And then after that, we started seeing videos of the actual Krampus runs, which is, I think, when I first heard about all this stuff, I really had no idea it was still an ongoing tradition. And, you know, it has been sort of reborn and reformed and revised, but I didn't know it was such a lively thing. And then, you know, so come mid 2000s, we're all seeing these videos, and before you know it, I'm trying to make masks and planning a trip to Austria and Bavaria, and kind of that was the seed of my book, basically trying to do arrange travel plans where I could see the most traditional stuff. And that sort of research became kind of the framework for the book itself.
It's really, really a must have, I think. The book has so many, well, first of all, it's full of beautiful pictures, but it's got so many great stories and talks about how these different folklore traditions are related to each other. And there's a lot of Germanic sort of Christmas traditions and really all over Europe that are quite similar in theme, I think. Sort of this dark or demonic or at least, I don't want to say ugly, monstrous, I guess is the right word. Then I find them weirdly beautiful in some of the pictures, even though I think they're supposed to be horrific. Did you come to any conclusions about why this is part of the Christmas tradition?
Well, I mean, I think really just the seasonality of things influence. I mean, the winter's a time when, I mean, if you go way back, the winter's in a time where, you know, in agrarian cultures, you don't have that much work to do, and it's cold outside, and it's hostile, and the nights are long, and you can tell stories to entertain yourself because you don't have streaming video. you know, all good stories require villains or monsters or adversaries. So I think really, honestly, I think the weather, the seasons, and the, you know, the work, the agrarian, you know, work cycles, life cycles influence storytelling. And so I think, you know, winter became a time for, you know, explore the inner life. You're working like a dog the rest of the year, but in winter, you know, there's time for fantasy, and then Christmas was a time for even greater indulgence, and it's the sort of the origins of all of our theatrical traditions come from early church plays. So I think it was the desire to celebrate and the sort of hostility, honestly, of the elements that kind of gave us this idea of like celebrating with an edge. And of course, Christian doctrine too, that provided lots of fun devils and devilry and catastrophic scenarios to dramatize. So I think all those things came together. You know, I can only really talk about Europe in this case, and the Krampus story is really about Europe. But yeah, I think it's all of those things really that came together in a perfect storm, and it kind of made for these traditions that Americans, we only inherited it sort of a thin dilution, a sort of weak sauce.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you've listened to the show, you've heard me talk about that sort of my upbringing was very much a fundamentalist Christian Southern Baptist kind of tradition, and I think there's in America there's been this sort of, and I don't know if it's literally puritanical, but that's probably the right adjective, this idea of keeping out anything that has sort of the resemblance to evil, but in the European tradition, it seems like this is a reminder of it's the stick to the carrot, or as you literally see in some of these traditions, it's the stick to the candy, right? Having the Krampus reminds you, we really haven't even talked about it. This is an audio show. Why don't you describe what the Krampus looks like?
I would imagine, you know, people have some ideas. Let's just start by saying there are sort of two kinds of Krampuses. I was talking earlier about the postcards, which I think are a little really more common and come to mind more readily in the U.S. And so that character looks like he's a black, usually a kind of dark colored black devil. Sometimes he might be red, and he's furry. Two horns, has a basket on his back to snatch away naughty children. Might have switches in his hands. That's the character that was designed for the postcards. But you have to remember that the postcards were created in sort of urban areas by artists that didn't grow up on farms. The actual tradition, the older tradition, goes back to, you know, farming communities in the Alps. And so their idea of what a Krampus is, they never had these pictures. So, you know, this stuff is going on. The postcards start circulating in the like 1870s or 80s. And the traditions are quite a bit older. So the older, the real Krampus, and this is actually what's kind of carried forward a bit more into the Krampus parades or Krampus runs, is kind of more bestial. He's a creation, something that you look, they would look at it and think, that comes from a farm, but like the devil's farm. So he'll have long fur. In Europe, the suits are made of certain, you know, certain kinds of alpine goats, which obviously it's cold. The goats have really long fur. So long trailing fur, and he might have more. The postcard devils are kind of more like sort of Mephistopheles or kind of a stage devil. They're a little more refined and effete, I might say. But the costume Krampus can have multiple horns. They're really bulky. The masks are a little oversized, so the whole creature ends up being a little taller than usual. I find them a little more daunting, actually. So he'll be like a furry devil. He won't necessarily have that basket you'll see in the postcards. He will have a belt with bells that add to the effect. It's sort of a loud, startling cacophony that he comes with. And the faces are, you know, kind of in the actual traditional mass are kind of like roughly carved. You look at that and you think that's folk art. Although now there's evolved a lot of newer style masks that are influenced by Hollywood movies.
Yeah, that's interesting. And in fact, speaking of movies, there's now been several movies that sort of that deal around with the topic. Yeah. Have you watched those?
Oh, yeah.
what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I live in L.A., so the producers of the film actually did reach out to us because I also run we do Krampus events in L.A. since 2013. We've been doing a Krampuslauf, a Krampus run now it's in downtown LA for the last several years, and some other events. So we'd kind of drawn together a bunch of people who are interested. And I went to an early screening of the film, and they wanted us to sort of help, you know, sort of grassroots promotion for it. And at the end of the film, they asked me how I liked it, and I just said, well, there wasn't any Krampus in it because it's so, so, so remote from anything that's related to the tradition. And I like horror films, and I like horror films that are funny, but I kind of didn't find the film, I mean, just as a film critic here now, I didn't find the film very funny or very scary. And it, you know, it's very different from the actual tradition. One of the things, like you were just saying earlier, the Krampus comes in a pack. He's a plural entity. He's a herd animal. So they took sort of a pack and stuffed them all together in one character, and suddenly you have like a 15-foot tall monster instead of a pack of, you know, man-sized creatures. I mean, that's just for starters.
Sure. the amount of artwork in your book is kind of amazing to me. I mean, it's full of these beautiful pictures, and they're from all over the place, it seems like. But first of all, how much of a role did you have in selecting the images, and was it...
I got them all together. They're all things that I pulled in. And the reason we have so many great pictures is because the various troops across Europe they're proud of their mask. They're proud of their troop. And so they're eager to, and the mask carvers also, they're happy to have their work shown. So it was kind of a matter of pride to supply photos. So it worked really well in that way.
That's fantastic. I wanted to put this later in the interview, but let's just jump to this question. So tell me about the Krampus run, because it seems like it fits in with a holiday tradition. It reminds me a lot of some of the other sort of fan-based social activities like zombie runs and other sort of cosplay events. Is it as old? I mean, how far back do these go, and what do they represent?
Oh, well, I would agree with you. In the U.S., as it's been adopted, the custom has been adopted here, and there are, I would say there's a couple dozen at least cities in the U.S. that have some kind of Krampus run in one form or another. But, we're emulating a tradition that started in the Alps of Germany and Austria. That goes back, and I always have trouble with this because it depends what you call the thing we call Krampus kind of evolves slowly, and there's many roots and things to trace. But, you know, roughly you could say to the 1700s or 1800s, and then it went through various cycles and stages of evolution. I think the thing what we would recognize as a Krampus run maybe really isn't much older than the teens and 20s, 30s, and then even the masks that we recognize now as Krampus masks really some of them the style kind of evolved even the 1980s, 70s, 80s, 90s. So yeah, how old it is kind of another question, but this idea of rowdy processions occurring around the holidays is, you know, that if you look at that as the phenomenon versus this horned beast that punishes children, the idea of a sort of disruptive carnivalesque public gathering of people causing mischief, basically, you know, that you can easily trace back not only to the Middle Ages, but to Saturnalia, even further back. So that's always the question, like, what do you mean by this? Or
I didn't even think about that. But didn't Saturnalia involve also something to do with switches?
Lupercalia.
That's it.
Lupercalia. I really guess more people that's around February, February 13th, which and actually doesn't have anything to do with Valentine's Day, despite all the people who will tell you it does. I mean, you could make a case for it, I suppose. Yeah, Lupercalia has to do with switches. What's interesting is, before we talk about this, I do feel it's incumbent upon me to provide one other basic fact about all this.
Okay.
Let me back up a bit. So we have these crazy wild Krampus runs, and people may know about them. It's packs of Krampuses running through a city, swatting people with switches. And that's one phenomenon. But the Krampus is, he's not actually a Christmas creature or Christmas tradition.
Okay.
Associated with St. Nicholas. And St. Nicholas Day in the Catholic Church is December 6th. So the actual tradition involves these packs of Krampuses going from house to house with St. Nicholas, who is evaluating kids' behavior. So
it's your annual review.
Yes, your annual review. It's kind of like the last judgment on a small scale for kids. So you have the devil and you have the saint. What happened basically, to trace it one way, is we have this sort of ecclesiastic tradition. It's kind of a matter of folk Catholicism where you have this representative saint, St. Nicholas, going from house to house, and he has a representative devil, which is the Krampus, which is itself kind of a newer name for this creature. But let's just say he's a devil that comes with the saint. And so as this phenomenon really got started, it was more about these, they call it the house visit. And this is a much, I won't say it's a tamer affair, it's just a smaller scale affair. So they call them passing the little groups. They're led technically by St. Nicholas, and there might be six or seven Krampuses. So this is like the really traditional form of this, all of this practice, and it doesn't exist even in Austria and Bavaria. And again, I should maybe back up once again and say, when we talk about the Krampus, we're not talking about all of Germany. If you talk to somebody from Berlin about this, they think of it as kind of some weird southern hill. I will say hillbilly because there's a little bit the same idea in Germany as in the U.S. So there, it's kind of a rustic tradition of the South. So it's really just Bavaria, it's southern Germany, and then Austria. And it's not really all of Austria. It's the eastern part of Austria in the Alps. So it's a pretty small area. And then of that area, there's the what's left of the sort of older tradition, these house visits, maybe 100, maybe 200, I don't know, towns where these little house visits happen. And these are like little staged, plays in a way. There are parts that are scripted. This St. Nicholas will recite some rhymed verse when he arrives. And after that, maybe it kind of devolves into more spontaneous stuff where he'll ask the kids how they've been that year. And the kid traditionally has to, like, in the old days, they would recite some memorized Bible verse. And nowadays, it might be they have some other kind of memorized poem or they do a little performance. They're actually put to the test. And then they're rewarded. And then the next step of the visit is Nicholas reminds them if they aren't good in the next year. And then he whistles. He usually has a little whistle because, honestly, you need that to hear over all the crevices will be outside in their heavy masks with their bells ringing. And they'll hear that whistle and they know it's their cue to come in. So they'll come in and sort of storm through the house. And varying degrees of liberty they were given. I have seen old films from the 60s where they'll drag furniture outside into the snow and they drag everyone from the house. It's not just the kids. In fact, they're kind of, they're actually gentle with the kids. So there's some kind of planned chaos that's kind of ideally fun for everyone. I'm sure kids actually, they do get scared here and there. So that's one phenomenon. It's the house visit. And originally these Krampus runs, they kind of just evolved as these groups of, as I said, the six, seven, eight Krampuses, whatever, and a Nicholas going from house to house. And so it wouldn't be a planned parade route. But now as cities that didn't initially, where the tradition wasn't native, kind of embraced the tradition, you start having these bigger parades down the main street. And then so we're talking the 1910s, 20s with these house visits. Some of it exists here and there still, but took off in the 60s and 70s. And so by the 80s and 90s, you have big parades in cities like Salzburg and Graz where they will set up fencing between the audience and the Krampuses. But in the old days, it would be just rogue groups wandering around the city, and they would playfully, if they see you, they would chase, they'd chase you. And so you have two different things where you have the kids having their kind of rough and wild Sunday school lesson in the home, and then you have these, they're usually teenage boys or 20 somethings in costumes, and after they leave the home, they have some schnapps, and if they see you in the street, they're going to smack you and chase you. And so they're two different things. One thing is sort of an instructive thing, so ideally for the kids. The other is making mischief and having fun, just being rowdy when you're out on the street. So the Krampus runs more of that rowdy thing. It doesn't really have to do with judging, punishing, any of that. It's more smacking people for fun.
How much does alcohol figure in?
It's really... I don't have real honest data on that because I feel like when I talk to people, they put on a good face. Some people would admit that. I do believe it's become less of a factor. If you read old accounts, especially going back, it's obviously a factor. But because the media coverage, when something goes wrong, if somebody's drunk and misbehaves and actually ends up getting hurt, I think it's really kind of curbed it a bit. So, yeah, alcohol consumption. Some troops will say that you, if you drink any alcohol before the Krampus run, they'll kick you out of the troop. It varies, and it depends what area you're into, what part of Austria and how traditionalist they are.
The reason I ask is because I was wondering if it sort of fed into the Wassel traditions or any, do people provide alcohol when they come to visit, that sort of
thing? Yeah, absolutely. So going way back, when we go way back, we kind of generalize and we're not talking specifically about Krampus anymore, but we're talking, let's just talk about this sort of generalized winter. These areas have similar house to house Christmas visits by costumed people who offer some they offer some performance in exchange for food or drink, and they prefer drink, I think. So yeah, and this little sort of play that Nicholas and his devils present is a version of that. The Wassailers would be, you know, they have a song or a poem they would recite. This is their version. That's their performance that they give. And yeah, the in the areas where the house still exists, there is some understanding of some kind of gift that will be given. And now it's more, now it's usually going to be money and not, no, I'm sure people still get drink. They don't think they get food so much. But there is kind of an understanding that when you visit a house, there's some kind of payment. And I think some of the troops will even ask the money be donated somewhere. So, but you know, that I think that is definitely the same roots. Absolutely.
Yeah, it felt like that would have figured in. I wasn't really clear on that. But it's funny because the mask, the costumes, the people are putting so much effort into some of these. I mean, obviously it varies depending on where you're looking at. But the I was just wondering about how would you drink, how would you eat in those costumes? It's a very practical question.
Well, they're very, at least where it's traditional, they're very strict about not being seen without their mask on.
Yeah.
So yeah, you have to go hide behind the house or behind the barn or something and enjoy your, you don't take your masks off during the visit at all, even after the performance. I know with some of the tradition, like English traditions, and the English mummers that would disguise, going door to door around Christmas, would disguise their voices as a certain kind of voice they would do that sounds to me like a Donald Duck voice. so you couldn't recognize who they were, and also, you know, the idea is they would be a lot of these old Christmas traditions. The idea of being masked is, it's partly, you're partly representing something, but in some of these traditions, it's not so much you're representing something else as you're disguising your identity.
Yeah.
So, so you're representing some kind of supernatural being. And what I was going to say is with the old English traditions where you can't even let them hear your voice. The idea is, when you go to the house, you're supposedly bringing some sort of supernatural blessing to the house. You're blessing the house. You sing a song, and that's a sung blessing. But if you're just an ordinary person and they recognize you, it basically breaks the magic.
I was going to say, for our younger listeners, blessing is kind of like what they did before likes on Facebook.
Oh, so, yeah. It's like a thought prayer or a thought. Yeah. Good thought. It's good vibes. It's good vibes. I'm in California. That's what we'll say.
Sorry. I love this because it seems to fit into so many things I like. The sort of the cosplay aspect, the social tradition of doing these sort of thing. It was literally tradition, right? I mean, I feel like sometimes in this age of modernity, we lose a lot of these traditions because everything's happening online, or we end up living in little suburbs where that's just not a thing. When I first moved into this neighborhood, there were actually people in the neighborhood who got together and did Christmas caroling, and it was wonderful. And then when the kids grew up from that particular family that was organizing it, nobody ever picked up the tradition. So there's no need to put together the punch or any of that stuff. But I really enjoyed it while it lasted. And I can't help but imagine that if anybody were doing this in Kennesaw, which is my hometown, Krampus in Kennesaw just seems like a really natural fit. I think I'm going to take this up with some of my Halloween enthusiast friends and see if I can't get it going here on the East Coast. But you've been involved with sort of getting this going on the West Coast as an American activity. You want to talk about that a little bit?
I had read about this tradition for a while and wanting to see it in person. I started doing research for the trip. So I ended up going to an area. It's a bit south east of Salzburg, and it's called the town itself is called Bad Gastein, and there's some several other towns. The whole thing is the Gastein Valley, and I actually did is I looked on YouTube to see where the rowdiest, most crazy, violent stuff seemed to be happening, because I figured that was probably the oldest, and you know, it's not, if that was my conclusion, I was wrong at the time, because there are areas that are actually, there's an area in the Tyrol, which is not the same. I'm a bit like north of there, what I'm talking about, but there's an area in the Tyrol where they actually discourage tourists from coming, because it can be so violent. It's actually, it's really famous. It's so famous for being violent that they're Krampuses don't have horns because they could hurt somebody too much when they start wrestling and throwing people around.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Actually, that's what I'm told, at least. So they're sort of ogre looking masks. They don't have anything pointy that, because they're actually, there's like, it's full contact sport. If you see video of it, it's like the running of the bulls when they release the Krampuses. And the goal in particular, I mentioned earlier that I've seen an old film where you'll see the Krampuses pulling furniture out into the snow. That's actually become sort of ritualized. This is the area, by the way, it's just called East Tyrol. And Matrai is the city that's known for this. Don't go there. I don't think they don't want you to go there. But so what they've done is, when these house visits, I'm going to back up a bit more. In the house visits, the kids hide behind the kitchen table. The kitchen table is the dining room table. It's the kind of the center of the house. And it's usually, in the old farmhouses, it's going to be a heavy oak table or whatever. So the kids are like on, the benches behind the heavy table to protect them from the Krampuses when they come in. So of course the goal for the Krampuses is to remove the thing that is protecting the children. So that sort of evolved into them.
They're having to pull out the furniture.
They want to remove the table protecting the children. So you remove the table, you might as well throw it in the snow because that'll create inconvenience. In this town, Matrai, there's like sort of a big, looks like a racetrack setting or outdoor field, and they build a little mock-up of an Austrian kitchen, a farm kitchen, and they have the table, and so they seat grown men behind the table, and the guys costumed as Krampuses will charge out and try to pull the table away, which they inevitably succeed in doing because there's a lot more of them. And then, so that's, once that's accomplished, the object is to rip the shirts off the men who have decided to try to test themselves and hurl them in the snow and sort of jump on them and stuff. So it really gets violent. There was some injury a few years ago with this. Somebody ended up in the hospital with, I think, in a coma as a result of all this. So again, it's like, don't go there unless
you're into it, right? This sounds like it combines Christmas and Festivus, and this is one of the feats of strength. But
yes.
I didn't want to interrupt because it led into what I was going to ask you, how travel enter into your research. Like, how did you incorporate that into – this is not a armchair researcher kind of book, so –
Well, I dearly wish I could have traveled more. I did a handful of Krampus runs in one visit one year. And then really after that, I made a bunch of contacts that way. And after that, when I got into asking the nitty gritty questions, it was all online correspondence. I'm going to go back this year, I hope, and sort of pick up more detail. But it was sort of an intense like week and a half of running around between Krampus runs, and after that, it's just follow up. Yes, I was trying to find a rowdy traditionalist area. I settled in the Gustine Valley, and so I ended up getting an email from a friend of mine once I had arrived there. I'd just come back from my first Krampus run. I'd been pushed in the snow, so that made me happy. I was doing all I could to get hit and so forth. The thing is, the guys in their costumes actually, they have kid gloves when it comes to tourists or somebody. The towns are pretty small, so they kind of recognize if you're a local, or they definitely know if you're a tourist. So it was hard to get smacked. The woman I was with had no problem getting smacked because there's a sort of targeting of it. It's a weird kind of courtship thing with the guys in the costumes and women. That's like a whole other topic, but anyway, so I just gotten back from the run. I had been smacked. I was happy about that. I felt like it was a good luck that I'd gotten from that. And I got an email from a friend of mine who wanted to start doing, we hadn't really ever talked about it, but he it was the season. I was there on the day, and he was just thinking, well, why don't we do a Krampus run in L.A.? His name is Al Guerrero. And he was somebody that we had been involved in previous groups that had done sort of street theater, guerrilla theater kind of craziness. You mentioned cosplay, and I almost hesitate to mention this because it's gotten such a bad reputation in the ensuing years, but we were involved in a group called the Cacophony Society, which itself I don't think has a terrible reputation, but we created something called SantaCon or Santa Rampage with Hunt. You see, it's happened now. It's spread way beyond anything that we were going to claim responsibility for. But it's wherever you'll see, lots of cities have it. Dozens of cities in the U.S. where, you know, hundreds of people wear cheap Santa suits and run around disgracing the image of Saint Nick. So we basically had been involved in that in the throughout the 90s, and that had gotten kind of boring and attracted. It just became a mob scene that wasn't even fun. So, but I think everybody missed. You're talking about tradition. I think everybody missed this little homemade tradition we'd created, or we felt we'd been displaced from because it had gotten so big. So the Al and I, the two Al's, sort of got some more people together who had been involved in that sort of thing. And we started making costumes, and the thing, our Krampus run got, you know, bigger and bigger each year. And now we close off for a few years. Now we close off a street in downtown LA, and we have a friend of ours comes down from the Bay Area with a steam car that he built in our St. Nicholas rides and that. And we have maybe 3 dozen Krampuses running around and hundreds of spectators getting hit. And surprisingly, it goes pretty well. I think people, like, they understand the whole getting hit thing. Wow. Much better than you think.
Yeah.
It draws it's the streets closed off, so it's not just random passerby. So I think people that show up, they know the drill.
Yeah.
And we talk. I also, everyone's coached and sort of warned.
Right.
What kind of hitting we're talking
about. It's all fun and games until somebody. Right.
Well, the rule has always been we kind of just do what. Well, we don't do what Europeans do because there is more familiarity with the custom. But
had socialized medicine too. So.
Yeah, the smacks are like, and also in Europe, people are dressed really heavy. So being hit by this little broom, the switches are kind of basically a little stick broom.
Yeah.
You know, they hit them on their butt and their thighs. I hope I could say that word. And lower legs. And, you know, they have a winter coat on. It's not going to do anything. But we never hit on the like chest or face or anything that might, you know, being scratched with, that's the most common injury. People get scratched by these things in the eye, and that's serious.
So I don't want to lose track of just how good of a book this is, because it's really good. But I wanted to, without spoiling it, I wonder if there's, first of all, I had two questions related to content. One is there any particular Krampus lore that really stuck out to you as sort of like the elevator pitch for this book? And then the other question is, were there any stories that your publisher said, no, you can't include that?
Well, my publisher likes controversial stuff, which maybe the book might sell more if he didn't like it so much. But Feral House is known for publishing edgy stuff, so that wasn't really an issue. In fact, I think that would be what attracted him. I think one of the things that would surprise me and seemed kind of shocking was this idea that this Saint Nicholas and his devil, the Krampus, attached to the Nicholas's Saint Day on the December 6th is really only one of other kind of monstrous, monstrous inversions of saints. So every, like several, a lot of the saint days in the winter have a boogeyman associated with them. So like St. Thomas Day is, I think it's the 20th, 21st, or the eve is the 20th, I guess. And so there's a character that appears on St. Thomas Day. They just call Bloody Thomas. And he is, because this was the day that it'd be traditional, depending on what century you're talking about, they're traditional to slaughter animals for the winter to make sausage and so forth. So kids would see, like, it'd be traditional to see a lot of people walking around, butchers, I guess I should say, walking around covered in blood on that day. And I think what happened was people started making up stories about this bloody boogeyman that would come after the kids. And the next thing you know, you have an evil St. Thomas. And there's also an evil, they call it Chuck or Ugly Lucy or the Lutz, who is an evil St. Lucy. So finding out that, like, so St. Nicholas manages to sort of be detached from his devil. It's kind of bifurcated into two personalities. But some other saints actually just became evil on that day. Or he was it's more honest perhaps to say they were the boogeymen that appeared on that day, but they call him the bad Thomas or the bad Lucy. So the Krampus is basically the bad Nicholas.
That's wow. The boogeyman, and I come from North Georgia, and my grandmother was raised up in they're not really mountains, but the foothills of the Appalachians, and she always called it the booger man. And I've always been fascinated by trying to track down the etymology of that, and I haven't really had any luck.
I think that roommate ended up being in my book. That's actually so the word booger until like I think the 1700s meant spirit or ghost or supernatural. It was a supernatural being. So the odd thing is. There's the word Butz in German is the same thing. It's actually the same. It's a sort of parallel issue in the German. Butzmann or the means basically it's almost literal. It's almost in it's a sort of parallel construction in German.
That's a great. You mean where it's like it's two different languages but sounds almost the same?
Is it, yeah.
Yeah. God.
Yeah,
okay. We'll skip it. But I that's the kind of thing I would like normally stop and try to Google.
Used to mean spirit or ghost.
Yeah.
So your grandma is right.
Well, she was the family name was Gieren, and they were all from German stock. So I think they probably brought that down, or it might have been for the region. Like one half of my family's German, the other half is from Scottish.
Well, apparently it was. Both sides of the Anglo-Saxon equation.
Yeah, so even now, up near the tallest hill that's not really a mountain in Georgia is Brasstown Bald, and up near there is a place called Booger Hollow, and I've just been fascinated by trying to find out why. Right?
were there murders there, or am I just wishful thinking?
In Brasstown Bald or Booger Hollow?
Yeah, Booger Hollow. I just feel like I've seen something.
Oh, I don't know. I suspect it's not the only Booger Hollow in the Appalachians.
Oh, so, true. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's one of those local mysteries. It's near some of the oldest stone art from like Paleolithic times in America.
George. Petroglyphs?
Yeah, petroglyphs. Yep. Yeah, it's a Track Rock Gap petroglyph site, which is really close to Booger Hollow. And, a lot of locals, well, there's been some controversy because some people have sort of made some wrong archaeological conclusions. You know, folk archaeology, which is quite a bit different from real archaeology.
That happens.
Anyway, not super important, but I just find it, I love it when there's places around here like Murder Creek, you know? Why? What's the story behind that? I love the sort of getting place names down to like the stories that sort of cause them to be whatever they are. I just find that absolutely fascinating. So your book extends beyond the Krampus into lots of other folklore, but one of the more interesting chapters is about, I hope I say this right, Frau Perksta?
Oh, that's always hard. Perksta, if you want to be. Yeah, it's like a sound kind of.
Fair, it's about the ugly witch lady. Could you?
Yeah, or Perksta. You could say it just an SH sound. I think some areas they actually kind of make that sound. I've managed to jabber on about the history without talking about her, which is kind of strange. When I talk about the kind of older forms of this Krampus tradition, they're basically spirits that are associated with this Frau Perksta. So this Lady Perksta was representative of a class of Perksten, which are basically the early form of the Krampus. And so this Frau Perksta was sort of like an unchurched version of Nicholas. So she was in charge of the discipline of observing the behavior of children. Particularly, she was really more associated with female children and with also the house servants anybody involved with the process of keeping the house, sort of the domestic order, running, everything clean, and also spinning. She's very associated with spinning. So there's kind of different there's different ideas about what this character was. The one that's closest in time to us is was sort of a kind of evil witchy character that would punish. So basically, instead of December 6th, the Saint's Day for Nicholas, she would appear on Epiphany, and her name actually comes from an old Bavarian phrase that means the shining night, which is sort of basically mean it was used for Epiphany. So that's why she has that odd name. So she was basically Lady Epiphany. And again, kind of like this Thomas that I was talking about, or Lucy, she was a scary version of that Catholic holiday. Anyway, there's a nice woodcut from the 1700s that shows her in all her glory. And it's actually called the Butzenbest. So we have that word Butzen, the booger. So again, she's like the boogie or booger Pest. The way she's shown in that picture, I will describe that because it's pretty iconic of how to think of her. She's like an old crone. She's bent. She's humpbacked. She has warts in her nose. And interestingly, maybe you can put a picture of this on the website. She has her nose dripping with snot. So I believe the artist was going for some sort of pun there. So that should be very important to the Mountain Monster Talk crowd, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I was just, you think about body horror, and she puts the crone in Cronenberg, right? So
when you talk about Paris, it's sort of like, I believe this is where one of the reasons we have the witches considered to have this ugly nose is. So Frau Perste's nose is really an issue. So in some stories, I think this is the also said of the witch, Russian witch Baba Yaga. She has an iron
Baba
nose.
Yaga. I love Baba Yaga. Okay,
so. Yeah. So, you know, and also if people are familiar with Baba Yaga, you can kind of picture her, and that's what Perste looks like. Although unlike Baba Yaga, her role is different, but the sort of look is the same. And so in this one engraving or woodcut I have, she has a big basket on her back, stuffed full of children, and she has a distaff for spinning, which I think is going to be used to smack kids. This is from the 1700s, and we're seeing this boogeyman carrying away children in a basket, which is what in the early 1900s, late 1800s, we see with the Krampus. So we have this female character on January 6th who comes to judge children and scare them and beat them, torture them if they're not doing as they should, not towing the line. And then you have this other character on December 6th, this Krampus devil. And so, you know, there's all of these parallel threads in this tradition. So what happened was the Perste tradition got borrowed into St. Nicholas Day and associated with the saint. And so that it sort of got christened or baptized by the church. Although I'm gonna back up that this tradition, the Krampus Nicholas thing, is kind of outside the church. It was kind of accepted, but it wasn't. But anyway, it's Christianized according to the people. That it was sort of this folk sort
well,
of.
Well, so in the course of doing Monster Talk, I've learned so many things, and one of the things. I think maybe Joe Laycock, who's talked to us a few times about, we've talked about Dungeons and Dragons and monsters, and he and his wife talked about tulpas and how they were changed. But the idea of hybridism and syncretism in religious traditions, so of merging two concepts together, sort of shaving off the parts that don't fit and just keeping the parts that work, and that happens again and again. And I know that a lot of people talk about Christmas being a pagan holiday that sort of got reappropriated. And I have to wonder, how many of these things were not necessarily hijacked as much as they were hybridized. And
I think that's a better word.
Yeah.
I think that's a much better way to look at it. Because also, what people are considering the whole area of what is Christian and what is pagan. I mean, also, when we say pagan, we kind of just mean not a little bit outside the church.
Right.
Part of the schooled ecclesiastic tradition of theological tradition, but you know the people that you know were involved in these practices kind of were fine working in both systems. I think, and I think that's where the Krampus falls. And you know, there is all it's a spectrum really. But yeah, to say one was stolen and became the possession of another is a little. I think that's a little extreme.
Well, it does the Frau Perste reminds me about the idea that. All the sort of grim fairy tales involving witches, you know, eating children, and you know, the idea of the ugly old witch. This is, you know, that's always to me been like a deep contrast to the idea of witches as, you know, the sort of Murray female empowerment through, you know, nature goddess. That's sort of, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there was a demonization of those characters. These may have been these folklore characters getting sort of merged in with people's idea of witchcraft.
Yeah, and I, you know, that whole, the idea of what a witch is has really changed over time. I mean, witches were not, like a different, they were like a different species.
Yes,
they were like a tempest or a vampire.
Yeah.
You didn't learn, you didn't study, you didn't get a spell book and learn to be a witch or practice some tradition. You were just, and you probably ate kids, you know?
Right.
And then as I think with the Spanish, with the Inquisition.
Inquisition.
And, you know, things, books like The Witch's Hammer, it started to become something that was a series of rituals versus the sort of, you know, the early words for witches are the same used for every kind of monster, practically.
Right. Yeah,
they weren't even human. They were a different species.
Which in my research into werewolves and silver bullets, it was obvious to me that silver bullets were used to kill witches because they couldn't be killed otherwise, which is quite a bit different from throw them on the fire, we'll take care of this, right? So,
yeah.
They were really problematic because they could turn into animals and they could avoid damage through natural, you know, weaponry. Like,
yeah, I think in those days, and this would apply to Frau Perchta and all of these, apply to Frau Perchta definitely. People never believed they would see her. She wasn't something you saw. She was something you talked about. So you didn't need to find her and burn her as a witch. She was just out there in the mountains or in the woods. So you would never actually encounter her. You just fear her. And you'd hear about somebody else. You'd hear a friend of a friend's story or some legend about the person that encountered her. But it wasn't somebody you looked for in your village, you know?
Right, right. It's the sort of the difference between a myth and a monster. Like, I mean, you know, there's lots of cases. Like, nothing really is coming to mind right now. But there are a lot of monsters that you don't really expect to see.
Yeah.
And there's creatures from mythology you don't really expect to see. Oh, Medusa. You don't really expect to see Medusa. She's a character in a mythology. But the idea of the Gorgon, I don't know that in particular. Maybe people did think they could see Gorgons. I don't know, but you know.
I think that's an interesting thing to think about because it relates to what, I mean, I was kind of posed questions like this during when I was working, doing interviews with the book, and people did not believe that the Krampus was an actual monster out in the Alps, out in the snowy, you know, rock fields of the Alps. At the time that name came about in the 1900s, people might believe, you know, the Krampus, it was kind of a fun game for children. So people were not actually scared. Even children were scared of it because people would dress up as this thing and come leaping into the house, making lots of noise and maybe smack some people around. But yeah, it wasn't like a tradition that people believed in that way. It was a kind of consensual game in the community. Now, the further back you go, you might have people believing it, but even in the 1600s, 1700s, I think these people were dressing up as characters from their mythology to have fun. But I don't think, you know, we like to, you know, so we're so like prone to say the ignorant peasants of this or that era. A lot of these things are not. They're not things that peasants were frightened of necessarily. There was a way to have fun and make the cosplay of the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it may have been symbolically important more so to some people than others, but you're right.
Yeah.
The artistry, the tradition of carrying out these sort of reenactments or these role plays, it seems astonishingly modern to me. I mean, you know.
And I think we kind of inherited, the sort of 19th century sort of attitude towards previous centuries and uncivilized, so to speak, you know, cultures. I think we need to give them more credit and realize that they were playing games that were, you know, are just as sophisticated as what we, you know, what we play.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that does get lost a lot. People have a sort of intellectual smugness about modernity. Yeah. Meanwhile, on the flat Earth, yeah. Anyway, I guess we need to kind of wind up. So let's see. We've talked about your podcast. We've talked about your book. Is there anything you'd like to talk about? You seem like you've been actively involved in sort of underground art and public acts, sort of these artistic events. Is there, would you like to talk about that a little bit? About what, you know?
I guess I snuck a little in about the Cacophony Society.
You did, yeah.
That was, I did, through the 90s, I was involved in that group. That, if people, it's not really well known now, or maybe in the West Coast, it's a bit well known more. People that might have heard of the Burning Man Festival, I should make clear that the Cacophony Society started that, much like the Santa Rampage, the Santa Mass, Santa rabble-rousing thing that we started. It's kind of grew on to become its own thing.
Which sounds really funny. I don't know if it is, but it sure sounds hilarious.
It was. I think what happened was it got bigger and bigger, and with larger larger groups, there's less sense of any individual responsibility. And with less responsibility, I'm not saying it got a little out of control, but also it's less fun. I think when we were like dressing up as Santa and running around, it was a smaller group, so there was a little more. It was a little more frightening for us, which is more stimulating and exciting.
Yeah,
you know. Once it became sort of like a, you know, big, you're running big buses and people are all filing out and there's 200 people and it's a different thing.
What was it called?
The original group is called the Cacophony Society.
I meant the Santa thing in particular.
Oh, Santa Con or the Santa Rampage. I think their Santa Con is the most common phrase to describe it. It's also some people what called it Santarchy.
That's not bad. But, I would have gone with Ho 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 Down.
You know, that might have been used by this now too. A friend of mine did it with a group in Japan, which has continued to do it in Tokyo. It's like all over. I know there's groups in London. In the UK. I think there's a website called SantaCon.com, not endorsed by me, but or anybody originally involved. I think they're trying to sell the cheap Santa suits that people sell. But that was something we started. The Cacophony Society would do other kind of, at the time, it was the 90s. So we were all talking about subverting the flash mobs is something that came out of that world. Flash mob is kind of like the Santa thing I'm describing, except the Santa thing is a prolonged thing, and there was people could actually announce a meeting point and so forth, or was a little less secretive. So the Cacophony Society did sort of different kind of prankish things, along with like touring. We organized tours to like outsider art sites and UFO cult headquarters and stuff like that. And then we'd do some other prankish shows, themed shows.
And you're also friends with Dr. Paul, is it?
Kudinaris?
Kudinaris, yeah. And he'd been on, I forget what episode number it was, but it was back in 2014 talking about demon cats we talked about. Yeah.
Oh, his thing is, I thought it was maybe ship cats. It was demon cats, right? He has different cat lectures he does.
It was really interesting. I just thought it was cool because I think it may be the first time we've had on a second guest who was friends with another guest, but I didn't put it all together. Yeah, I mean, people know each other professionally, but you guys you've known each other a long time, right?
Yeah, he did stuff with, you know, stuff with the Cacophony Society. Yeah, I've known him for 15
years. I really need to get out to LA sometime and have some kind of like Monster Talk alumni meetup.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to meet the other Monster Talk listeners out here.
Yeah, it would be really cool.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about giving out contact info.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, actually, let's do one more question and then we'll do that, okay? So let's do...
It's your show.
Yeah, well, we can do it now. However, whatever, it doesn't matter. You want to talk about that? So you've actually got some things you're working on. Yeah. So what, how do people get in touch with you? How do people get your book?
Well, the book is, it just, you can go to Amazon, amazon.com. That's the easiest way. You can also buy it, through, feralhouse.com. That's the publisher.
And the title again is The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas.
Yes. Thanks. And, so there's that.
And we'll put a link in the show notes, obviously.
Yeah, great. And I'm also if we need to get the we need to get enough signups for this, but I'm also set to presuming that happens to lead a Krampus tour this year in Austria and Bavaria.
That sounds so fantastic.
We're going to the Salzburg and Graz, so the cities will be in for the Krampus runs, and we're doing several in those cities. Graz got kind of well known because there's a spectacular video was shot like the sun's going down, the snow is falling, and the camera was in just the right position. So a good catch-all is just alreitenauer.com, and then they can also, I'm on Facebook under that name, and they can also go to boneandsickle.com. Such a troublesome phrase to use. It's not an ampersand, and it's spelled out, and there's no hyphens or dashes.
And it's definitely, definitely. In fact, if you listen to me and follow instructions, you should have already signed up for it. But definitely subscribe to Bone and Sickle, because if you like Monster Talk, you're really going to get a kick out of it. It's awesome. So that brings us to the final question, Al.
Oh, the final question is.
Yeah.
My favorite.
Al,
what's
your favorite monster? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I've given this some thought, and it's sort of dishonest. I mean, obviously I wrote a whole book about the Krampus, so that's kind of my favorite monster. But as I said earlier, I grew up loving all different monsters. It's not a fair question. I'm going to go kind of close to the Krampus though, and mention, I'm gonna nominate the Habergeist, which is another alpine monster. It's sometimes they call him the pet of the Krampus or the Pershing, and it's a goat. It's sort of a monstrous monster goat character. There's different ways of representing him. He could be so you'll actually see this these guys dressed. You'll occasionally see people dressed as a Habergeist, and it could be it could be like a pantomime horse with two guys, and there's always a long neck, like a giraffe neck, and you might wonder why should a monster goat have an extended long neck. And the reason is one thing you find in most of the parade costumes that are used is there's a spring activated jaw that the guys underneath operate, and so this big neck is for swinging out and stealing people's hats or biting at people. So he's very intrusive.
Wow.
So I mean, that's the parade figure, but there's all these other stories. There were stories told about how it was like a banshee, that it would appear in your fields before somebody in the house would die, or other stories have it being like a half bird, half goat creature. It could sit on your chest like the night hag, causing sleep paralysis. So it's really like, I'm going with that one because it's like a real multi-function monster.
Neat. It looks very cool. And of course, now it reminds me of Black Phillip from the Witch movie. Have you seen The Witch? It's I assume you have. But
I love The Witch. The Witch is the pure kind of folklore meets horror thing that I love. And
Al, let me just say, I really appreciate you making the time to come join us on Monster Talk. I can't recommend your material enough. Hopefully people get that out of this interview. This is going to go up fast. I think this will probably go up next week.
Awesome.
I love the Krampus in July title. This is going to be...
I hope it brings people the thoughts of cold, snowy, alpine crests. I think that should be a pretty appealing to people across the country right now.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and tonight we were in conversation with Al Reidenauer, the author of Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, and the host of the highly recommended podcast Bone and Sickle. Reidenauer's valet Wilkinson was portrayed by Rick Gallagher, and appeared by special arrangement with Bone and Sickle. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. If you're going to be in the Frankfort, Kentucky area in September, be sure to come see me at CryptidCon, a conference focused on cryptids and monsters. It's September 8th and 9th, and I'll be giving a talk about the Kelly Hopkinsville goblins. Stop by and say hello. And check out their website at cryptidcon.com.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psyconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy-Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rubb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Oh, did I lose?
No, I'm here. I'm just listening. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No, I was actually,
let me be honest. Let me be completely honest. I was sitting here trying to figure out how to make a benchmark pun. So.
Well, we can edit one in.
No. It's okay. I want them to be all organic and natural. So.
So